Well, the topic that I wanted to address this evening, or just kind of talk around or reflect on, is the topic of dependence, or as stated in Buddhism, dependent co-arising. A very important Buddhist topic. And I'm inspired partly because of this newborn baby we have at home. He's 5 weeks old now. He's completely dependent. It really struck me the last few days how he's dependent on his caretakers, you know, 110%. You know, he can't do anything. All he does is, you know, he waves his arms, unless he's crying, which is a very effective way of getting attention. But we have to, you know, feed him and change him and burp him and clothe him and diaper him, and, you know, it just goes on and on. And he can't do any of it for himself. And I'm surprised. I am surprised. I've had a lot of surprises in the last 5 weeks. There are things that you know intellectually that are a surprise when you learn them practically. And I suppose that things go along normally, what will happen is that he will at some point start becoming more independent, more autonomous, be able to do things more for himself. And so that means that at some point he can dress himself and feed himself and get a job and move out. Take care of me when I become dependent. And I suppose that one of the things that happens is as we develop kind of a normal course, become more independent in a sense, the sense of independence overshadows the radical sense of dependence, which actually remains. And one of the fundamental teachings of Buddhism is that Buddhists like to reflect on a lot, both as part of meditation practice and as a teaching, is the degree in which who we are and what our environment and reality is like is dependently co-arisen. It arises based on infinite number of conditions all around us all the time. So today we had the children's program at 7 o'clock, and I brought with me a piece of chocolate. And then we had a big piece of paper, white paper, and the chocolate was in the middle. And I asked the children to reflect on all the conditions that brought the chocolate to them. And then I would write down what they wrote on this piece of paper and making these webs of connections. And we, after a while, you know, they had lots of fun. They got all excited. And they looked, they read the ingredients on the chocolate and could, you know, saw all the different elements. And you got this phenomenal web they started creating. Now, first they said there was, well, you need the chocolate maker. And for the chocolate maker, you needed to have milk, which you needed to have cows, you needed to have the farmer, which you needed to have the farmer's parents, and you needed to have the sun and the water, and you needed to have, in order for the, you needed to have the bucket to collect the milk, and you needed to have the bucket maker, and you need to have the person who transported the milk to the Swiss chocolate factory. So you needed a truck driver, and you needed the truck driver's parents, and you needed the truck driver's, you need someone to sell the truck to the truck driver, and they said you need Goodyear tires, and you needed rubber, you know, and went on and on, filled the page. And after a while, I think all of us were kind of amazed, you know, at the level of interconnection that you need to have, the conditions that are in place in order to just have this bar of chocolate, which we often take for granted. And I've made the point that, in a sense, you know, the whole world is the condition for this particular bar of chocolate. The whole world kind of isn't creating it. So the ways, there's phenomenal ways in which we're connected and really dependent on each other that we often lose track of when we become seemingly autonomous and can make choices for ourselves. Maybe this is a kind of a footnote, But somewhat maybe along the same line. Buddhism tends not so often to look at causality as much as it tends to look at conditions. And it wants us to understand the conditions that need to be in place so other things will happen. And if you take away the conditions, maybe the other things won't happen. But it isn't necessarily that the conditions cause what happens. So for example, us meeting in this room, one of the conditions that allows this to happen is the presence of this building. And we're not meeting here because of this building, but it's, you know, one of the conditions that allows us to meet. So I think it's Bob Bennett, or is it President Clinton's lawyer, and he said that you can't trust Linda Tripp. And therefore, she says that she felt she had to defend herself, so she decided to tape Monica Lewinsky's telephone conversations. And it went on from there, right? And who knows, it's hopefully not the case, but who knows what the connection is between that and what's going on in Iraq. And could we see a chain of conditions between Bob Bennett's statement to the press and 100,000 deaths in Iraq? Now, it's not, I don't think it's too far-fetched to see that level of connection of conditions. And so if Bob Bennett hadn't said that, would international politics look a little bit different right now than it would have done otherwise? So what are the conditions and the tremendous ways in which we're interrelated? And probably if we reflect on it, we find probably infinite number of conditions like what Bob Bennett said that are responsible for all the same things. It isn't just not responsible, but contribute to this particular thing happening. But we can single out this particular condition because it's been in the news, but there's been a lot of others. So this idea of dependent co-arising, that things arise dependent on many conditions, is taught in Buddhism and reflected on and meditated on as a way to help us become happier, help us to be free of our suffering. Because it's said that one of the fundamental forms of suffering is the false sense of autonomy, the false sense that things are independent and live and exist in a kind of self-existing kind of way. And the teaching of dependent co-arising is a teaching that says nothing is really separate, and nothing is absolutely separate from anything else, and nothing is absolutely independent. That things arise depending on the conditions that come into place to support it arising. And you take away the conditions and it passes away, disappears. And in Buddhist practice, there are two general forms of mindfulness practice. One is a reflective practice, where the student will, practitioner will reflect and think about certain themes. And one of the ways in which people reflect is they think very deeply about the conditions that come into place to create this particular event right now, or anything at all. So like the kind of thing I did with the children is that kind of reflective meditation. The Vietnamese teacher Thich Nhat Hanh talks a lot about this, this kind of reflective, deep listening or deep seeing into our reality by reflecting on all the conditions that come into place. And he often holds up a piece of paper and does the same thing. And what are the conditions that bring this paper into existence? And he talks about the same things I talked about with the kids. And I think it's very useful to do that kind of exercise because it tends to show us that how much we depend on others. We're not so independent. And with that, perhaps comes a sense of gratitude, comes a sense of compassion, comes a sense of love, appreciation, that our life is dependent on so many things around us. A sense of awe, a sense of maybe, I feel a tremendous amount of awe, almost mystery, when I reflect on how my life is sustained and supported by all the conditions around me. When I was a botany student, when I was a college student, I took Introduction to Botany. And for me, that was the closest thing to a religious education that I've ever gotten in a classroom. Because we would learn about the cycles of nutrients, and I would leave the classroom with all this information about the cycle of nutrients and go out and look at a tree in the courtyard. And I would wonder, where does a tree stop and where do I start? Where do I stop and where does a tree start? And you know, I thought, reflected at that time about how, you know, I could do without perhaps one of my lungs. I could maybe do without one of my kidneys, and many things I could do without that are, I think, are integral parts of who I am. But I can't really do without the plants that produce the oxygen. And if I can't do without them, aren't they, in a sense, part of who I am? If my life is dependent on their existence, how separate am I really? And then it got more amazing, the botany class, when they started talking about cells. And they taught us, one of the theories back then was that inside the cells, there's this little energy factory called the mitochondria. You know about those? And one of the theories is that mitochondria, many, many billions of years ago, were actually an independent little one-celled organism that was swallowed up into a bigger cell. And then through all these billions of years, as all these cells have multiplied and divided and multiplied and created all this complicated life we have, the mitochondria, this little other cell, this other kind of organism, has kept multiplying with it. So in our cells is an organism which is not us. Every cell of ours and the energy source for who we are, for all our cells, is not us, it's another organism. What does that make us? Who am I then? So I was kind of blown away by these kinds of things that I was studying in Introduction to Botany. So the idea of reflecting on this brings a sense of awe. But it's also not just simply reflective meditation, but it's also a kind of the study of dependent co-arising, the ways in which things arise in the moment, dependently on all on other things, is also something that's revealed through not reflective meditation, not through thinking about it, but through the kind of non-discursive form of meditation that we do in mindfulness. When the mind becomes quiet and silent to some degree, when the mind is not caught up and blinded by all its thoughts and ideas and what's going on, when the mind, or when we don't place ourselves, locate ourselves in the future or in the past or in our fantasies, we don't locate ourselves in some kind of fixed identity and are preoccupied by this identity. When the mind is silent, it doesn't have those kinds of preoccupations, there's a possibility of seeing very dramatically how things arise in the moment that we often took before as being unitary, permanent kind of events. One of the classic things we talk about a lot in Buddhism is the sense of self, the idea of self-identity. I am who I am, and I know who I am, and I have to be true to myself, and I have to express myself as if we really think we know who myself really is, as if it's some particular thing that's not arising in the moment itself. I don't know if this is a good example, but it's been about 7 years now since I've been teaching here in Palo Alto in this sitting group. And when I started teaching 7 years ago, I was kind of a beginning teacher. I'd done a little bit of teaching before, but not much. And I was just kind of had my teacher's training wheels. You know, it was a small group. There were 12, 15 people, and it was a good place to kind of begin, because I would have been shared shitless to have talked to such a big group back then. And one of the things that's very very clear to me is that who I am as a teacher, in the role that I, to the degree in which I'm a teacher, and which is a role I hold sometimes, has arisen, co-arisen, is dependent on, in part, this community here, and that we together as a community, me and you and me, have in part created me as a teacher. It isn't like I'm independently wise and wonderful and, you know, profound and or what. I don't know what, you know, a teacher is supposed to be. As if that's something, you know, I've inherited from time immemorial or from God or from whatever. Partly who I am as a teacher. The position I hold in this community, and the way that I can bear myself and carry myself in this community, and my comfort for speaking, and the way I'm seen by people, is in part created by all of us together. And it's a good thing that I realize that, because if I didn't realize that, my wife would have divorced me. If I had gone home and continued with thinking that this is who I really am, it would have created a lot of difficulty in other parts of my life. So it's something that we created together here. And I understand that in part who I am in this role is something we've created together. Because of these conditions, partly who I am has come into being. And if these conditions dissolve, that part of myself won't exist. When the mind becomes quiet and still enough, it's possible to actually see the birth of the self in the moment. The self is born moment by moment, not, you know, at your biological birth. So, for example, someone brings me a gift. You know, one of you bring me a gift, and maybe you come and give me a wonderful bell. And that's nice to have a bell. But what gets created in that moment, perhaps, is myself as the owner of that bowl. And before you gave me that as a gift, it wouldn't have occurred to me that I was the owner of the bowl. But that sense of the ownership, of being an owner, is born in the moment that it's given to me and I kind of come to the conclusion I'm now the owner. That's born in the moment. It's born by those conditions. Me as the owner didn't exist before. And what Buddhism wants to say is that all the normal kind of conceptions and ideas that we get stuck and hung up about and suffer because of arise in the moment in many, many small interactions like that. Then you might say, well, that's all fine, but what about awareness itself? What about consciousness that's aware of all these things going on? That seems like it's unitary, it seems pretty independent. It seems like that probably qualifies as a self. And the Buddhism, in the teachings of dependent co-arising, it very, very clearly states that awareness or consciousness itself is also dependently co-arisen. It itself arises out of conditions that call it into place. And when those conditions pass away, it passes away also. And it arises in the moment just like the sense of self arises. Consciousness is a construct in a sense. And this is very fascinating to what modern scientists are finding out when they try to delve into what is consciousness. It's a very hard question to figure it out. It isn't like this obvious thing for scientists to decide, you know, that they know what it is. We all know what it is, right? But the scientists can't figure it out. And what they're finding is it's incredibly complicated and complex phenomena that is a construct that arises in very complicated ways. I give one example, which I think is kind of interesting. Can you be aware of something you're not conscious of? And if that's the case, then what does that say about consciousness? Or can you be conscious of something you're not aware of? So apparently there are people who have some kind of damage to their nerves of their eyes, kind of somewhere between their eye and where sight gets registered in the brain. There's some kind of damage. But there's apparently a number of forks in where the eye signals go in the brain. But the fork that takes it to the place in the brain where it says, you know, I'm seeing, you know, I see the door over there. You know, you kind of see the door. If that linkage sometimes doesn't work for some people, and you say, ask them, what do you see? And they say, I don't see anything. And then you say, where's the door? And they'll point to it. Because they haven't seen it in the place where the sight consciousness happens, but the brain registers it, because the eyes work. It's just somehow the internal wiring, right? So what does that say about consciousness and awareness? What is it? Do we know? It gets very complicated. If consciousness and awareness is so multifaceted, if it's multifaceted, then it can't be unitary, which is what the illusion is when we sit in the middle of it often. So Buddhism says that consciousness itself arises in the moment. More interestingly, the teachings of dependent co-arising says that consciousness itself, one of the conditions that brings on consciousness is ignorance. And that's a fascinating idea, that your ignorance brings on your consciousness. Now, I can't say I really understand this.
insulting, doesn't it?
Sorry? What?
I said it sounds insulting.
Insulting?
Non-sequitur.
Non-sequitur. Sound insulting? And I like that, it's insulting. There's many ways of receiving Buddhist teachings. One of them is to be insulted by them. Which maybe better than than appreciating them, actually. So another way of appreciating them, another way is to be inspired by them. But one of the best ways, I think, is to be challenged by them. And so not necessarily to buy into them and not to kind of discount them, but to really be challenged by them, to really think deeply, reflect deeply, look deeply at what is going on. Yes, Rainbow.
At the third word that I'm thinking about, it's not consciousness, it's not awareness, sentience, to be sentient.
What is that?
Well, I'm trying to see how that fits in with these other words. I think one of those words is supposed to mean to be aware of your own mortality.
Sentient
usually means like knowing.
Yeah.
It's like a Latin word for knowing.
Like
being able to know.
Fish are not sentient, right?
They're
not?
Yeah.
I think they're sentient.
Fish are sentient?
A mother of fish.
They don't know they're going to die, right?
You would don't know they're going to die.
Sorry?
You would don't know they're going to die.
Do you hear that, Rainbow? Steve says most humans don't know they're going to die.
Oh, so that's not okay.
Yes.
I was just going to follow up. When I hear the word sentience, what I think of is self-awareness, in the sense of being aware of oneself as a being, having that sort of construct. They say that humans are sentient. Some of the higher apes are definitely sentient, and they can look at a picture of themselves and say, hey, that's me.
And fish?
Unless you're trying to appreciate it.
Gail?
Yes.
Does a fish have Buddha nature?
I always thought the word sentient meant sensing, but not necessarily like a construct of a self. I mean, it would react or respond to other things in general.
Yes.
Say again how the understanding and the arising leads to suffering.
Good question. The teaching of dependent arising is that suffering arises because of conditions. And if you understand the various conditions that lead to suffering, you can sometimes remove or lessen those conditions. And so, so the Buddha's actually very important teaching of dependent arising, specifically the causal chain, or the causal thing, the condition chain, the chain of dependence from which suffering is born. And it's usually called the 12-fold chain of dependent origination. And there's 12 links to this, and it's a circle, meaning it goes around and around, meaning there's no original beginning to it. It just kind of goes around and around, kind of feeds itself. And though the traditional beginning is often ignorance, that's where when people give talks on it, usually start with ignorance. And ignorance means various things, but it means one of the things it means is not really understanding the nature of a human being, not really understanding the nature of us as dependent beings, having the illusion that we're independent, separate, and that our experiences, like our suffering, for example. Or our anxiety or our fears or pride or identifications that has some kind of permanence that exists independent of the very many conditions that bring it together. So that's one of the very important conditions that lead to suffering. Based on ignorance, there's a number of other steps in the chain until we come to clinging. So first there's ignorance, and then there's the arising of a kind of sense of a human being. Based on ignorance, there's tendencies. There's dispositions of the mind, tendencies that we have. And actually, based on our tendencies and dispositions, our prejudices, our biases, our desires, there arises a thing called consciousness. And right, depending on consciousness, there arises what's called the psychophysical being. And based on a psychophysical being, there is the six sense doors. So you can see and hear and think and all that. And once you can sense things, then when some sense object arises, there's sense contact with that object. And sense contact has a tone to it. It's a feeling tone. It's either pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. Depending on whether it's pleasant or unpleasant or neutral, we have a response to it. And response is either wanting or not wanting, pushing away or hanging on to it, desiring or not desiring. Some kind of desire arises. Based on desire, there's then clinging, and based on clinging, there is identification, there is preoccupation, there is resistance, there's all these things, and these things then lead to suffering, cause the kind of what Buddhism means by suffering that's born from that kind of clinging. So there's two conditions which are the focal point for freeing ourselves from suffering according to this kind of system. One is the point of ignorance, to somehow uproot the condition of ignorance, and then the whole rest of the circle doesn't follow. The other point is the point that from contact, when we feel the pleasantness or unpleasantness of experience, to simply learn to leave it there and not to react to the pleasant, unpleasant, or neutrality of the experience. And there's a very important mindfulness meditation exercise of paying careful attention to simply the pleasant and unpleasant qualities of our experience. And all experience has one of these three qualities: pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral. And the noticing how, based on its pleasantness, unpleasant, and neutrality, we come in almost like an amoeba-like reaction of either wanting or not wanting, either pushing it away or holding on to it. And the mind is still and quiet enough, you can actually see very precisely and very minutely this movement of desire or pushing away. And when you can see it clearly enough, then you see you have an option. You have an option whether to leave it alone, it's simply a pleasant or unpleasant experience. Leave the experience alone as it is. That's an option you have. Or the other possibility, if you want, you can get caught up in it. Getting caught up in it tends to create more suffering. So part of the value of this teaching and part way it lessens suffering is it tends to break up the idea, soften the idea, that our suffering is permanent and absolute. And that the conditions for suffering are permanent and absolute. Like, I'm this way because this is what happened to me as a child, or this is what happened to me, or my boss is this way, or... So it tends to soften it up. We say there's a number of conditions. And the focus in Buddhist meditation is to understand specifically those conditions within ourselves that contribute to our suffering. So not to kind of project the cause of the suffering outside of ourselves. There are many conditions which cause our suffering. Our boss might be one of the conditions. He's not the cause of our suffering. He's a condition for it. And it's a very important condition, and you have to take care of the boss or whatever, but it's only a condition because our suffering, this is where you might get insulted again. So if you want to be insulted, plug your ears. Or challenged, and this is where I really hope you get challenged by the statement, and that is that our suffering arises because something that we do to the conditions that happen around us. And it isn't that our boss is causing us suffering. It's the way we choose to respond to an unpleasant situation that then leads to our suffering. The boss might be creating an unpleasant situation, It's either pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. He has three choices. But then we buy into it because of our ignorance. We think we are a certain way. We think we have an identity. We have a lot of things we hold on to and cling to, and it could be a whole cornucopia, a whole kind of huge bag of luggage that we're clinging to and holding on to. And he comes along and says one thing, and it resonates with all that stuff in that luggage. But it's still our luggage. It's the ways in which we choose to react to it. It's the way we choose to hold on to it, or respond to it, make meaning of it. So when the Buddha taught about dependent co-arising in relationship to suffering, he kept pointing the finger back to our particular role in either being ignorant about the situation or in clinging or having resistance to the situation. The alternative to the idea of being, the idea of emptiness in Buddhism, which is one of these radical, insulting ideas, is that there is nothing which is separate and independent. That's basically what emptiness means. It means that we're all in it together. And in a wonderful way, the world is a co-produced event. We're all co-producers in this movie. And we start sensing that possibility of co-production and seeing how it gets produced together, then we begin to be able to play better in the field of this movie. We don't take it so seriously, or we take it more seriously, depending on, what's appropriate in a given situation. We learn to play by the rules of it. It's quite much more flexible than many of us realize. A lot has to do with the definition. A lot has to do with conventions. Conventions are incredibly fluid, and many of us take conventions as being how things really are. And one of the ultimate conventions is the sense of self. So it keeps coming back. How do we identify with ourselves? What do we take ourselves to be? And do we really need to do that? When our boss gets angry at us or threatens us or something, what sense of self is operating in that moment? What sense of self is produced in that moment? So that what he says gets hooked somewhere, gets caught somewhere. Why doesn't what he says kind of just pass right through you? Interesting information. I think I'll take that into account and make responsible decisions, but I'm not going to be fazed by it. Why? The idea, a lot of what mindfulness practice is trying to get to, and a lot of this idea of dependent co-arising is supposed to getting to, is to bring us to a place where we can trust being alive in a responsible way, taking care of things responsibly, going about and doing everything we need to do, but not having to put up any resistance to what actually happens and not having hold on to anything. It's very simple. That's it. And then people say, well, I can't do that. Doesn't make any sense. Because. But that's where the challenge should be, to really understand, do we really need the many forms of resistance, the many forms of clinging and attachment, which underpin much of our behavior in our life? But in order to do that investigation, it's very useful to have a very quiet and calm mind. The quieter and calmer the mind is, the more clear it's possible to see how the sense of self, how our suffering gets arisen in the moment itself. Yes?
Well, I think maybe a lot of the drama that you're talking about here makes us feel like we're real or something. Mm-hmm. So if we let go of all of that, then...
we're not real.
Who will we be?
Yes,
yeah,
who will we be? As if we have to be someone. Right?
That's, but it is kind of scary.
It is. Right. And it makes sense for it to be scary because... I don't know if I want to go into this now, but does this interest you guys a little bit?
Yeah.
Should we continue next week?
Yes.
Can you hold on to yourself until then?
No problem.
Can we let go of ourselves?
Then you don't have to come. But it is frightening, and many of us have the sense that it's necessary to hold on to some kind of identity in order to survive. And the challenge is, do we really need that? How much can we let go of and still function quite freely and responsibly and in the world, take care of ourselves? That's the challenge. And it isn't that we have to kind of become... it isn't that our sense of choice disappears. We still make choices. But we realize that choices happen in this whole field of codependent arising. And what's fascinating, when your mind gets really still and really quiet, very mindful, very precise, it's fascinating what you discover about your choice, about the ability to choose. Where does choice arise? You know, if you think a choice is... Probably the best qualifier, the best thing that qualifies as a self for Buddhists is your ability to choose. But if you really get quiet and really look at where choice arises from, you know, it's like... It's psychedelic. It's like, where does it, you know, it's like, you know, where does it, doesn't arise from anywhere. Just these conditions come together and choice arises and there's no chooser. It's just an amazing thing to watch this thing called choice arise, and there doesn't seem to be any chooser that's part of it. We might attribute a chooser to it, but that's an attribution, and many of us take the attribution for the real thing. But if you're really attentive and don't label it as a chooser and just allow the choice to arise, you can't see a chooser. If you can't see a chooser, where's the chooser?
Who's seeing the choice?
There's seeing, but no seer. And so this requires a mind that's calm and very concentrated and very mindful to be able to separate, begin to distinguish some of the ways in which we construct the world, to see that at the root of it there is nothing. No self there to begin with. As we begin to realizing this, and as the ignorance begins to soften and the sense of trust begins to develop, then one of the things we realize is the world is a participatory event. And so then the part of the joy of practice, the joy of life, is throwing yourselves into the world as participators without the kind of normal self-consciousness which gets in the way. When we're not self-conscious, when there's no consciousness in a sense, then there can still be participation. But what is a participation like if there's no self-consciousness or no consciousness? And there's no sense of self. Can there be participation? Can there be choice? Can there be this full-hearted, wholehearted involvement in what you do without that kind of reflective, constant reflective looking back at myself? How am I doing? Am I doing good enough? You know, all the various forms of that. So two things, you know, this what we do in mindfulness practice, especially on longer retreats, is the mind becomes still enough to really see. It's often called a deconstruction process. We become still enough; we can really see all the different kind of ways in which we construct our world. Really, that's one thing we learn. And the other thing we learn is to have the trust to throw ourselves in a more wholehearted way into this world we live in. So the idea of dependent co-arising is not a teaching that keeps us separate from the world, but actually encourages us to actually be more wholehearted participants in
bland.
In what?
To blend.
To blend?
Yeah.
To blend. Oh, to blend. But I will we'll talk more about your question next week. And one of the important distinctions to help, I think, sort out the problems we have with self and no self and Buddhist teachings is the Buddhist distinction between what's called conventional truth and ultimate truth. And in order to understand the kind of worldview that comes out of meditation practice, it's necessary to have kind of bifocal vision. And if you understand the bifocal vision, then you kind of have a sense of how to go back and forth and actually honor two different worldviews at the same time. And it's neither this or that is a very, very fundamental Buddhist teaching. That's for next week. Neither this or that? Well, we'll talk about it next week. Yes?
Is that bifocal vision that you're referring to the sense of the uniqueness as well as the fact that there is, or the sense that there is no self?
It could be, yeah, it could be.
And that those two could actually be part of that same training.
It could be, yes. Stay tuned for next week. Yes?
It's not quite as catchy, but after listening to you, it seems like ignorance it doesn't lead to consciousness, but knowledge of your ignorance leads to consciousness. And that a fair statement?
Well, you know, as I said, I don't really understand this particular teaching of. I don't understand it in the way that is helpful for me. I can give you a textbook, reason for why ignorance builds leads to consciousness, but I don't really understand. Last one, and then we should.
The way I'm understanding in the talking of panic arising and ignorance is almost as if the panic arising is a wedge which begins to crack open another ignorance.
Yes. That's good.
Looking at or sensing that if ignorance is ignorance of our separate self, or our lack of self, the teaching of dependent co-arising can be looked at as a wedge that can help break open that ignorance, because it's contradictory to the sense of separate self. That is the teaching of dependent co-arising. And so my sense is to fully experience or to understand that from an experiential level really is the beginning of the letting go of it.
Yes. Yeah. And another thing that this whole notion of dependent co-arising helps us with, in a sense, is to appreciate in a reflective way the degree in which our world is codependently arisen. And so we can actually start making choices because we realize that our choices today affect things in 20 or 30 years. What happens in 20 years is dependent on the choices we make today. And one of the ways this is beautifully stated was by Thich Nhat Hanh. Back in the time when the Vietnamese boat people were fleeing Vietnam and were being captured by pirates, sometimes Thai pirates off the coast there, he was very concerned about pirates and the violence they were doing, the murder and the raping and the pirating they were doing. And he pointed out that the conditions of today will lead or create the conditions for the pirates of 20 years from now. And so the degree of poverty that exists, you know, today is not just simply, you know, terrible for what it is today, but it's creating conditions that is likely to lead to having pirates in the future. And so we want to be very careful with our conditions. One of the ones I saw in the paper today, which I thought was fascinating, was we're all up in arms literally about Iraq's chemical and biological weapons program. The Reagan administration supported and encouraged that same activity, not only the building up of it, but the use of those weapons when Iraq was fighting Iran. So here the United States government is supporting something and then coming around 10 years later and saying, hey, wait a minute, we don't like this. So 10 years ago or 15 years ago in the Reagan times, could we say that there, in some sense the conditions for the conflict today had its seed back then? So then more importantly the question is, what are the seeds that we're planting today that bear fruit in 20 years? And so one of the titles, a title of one of Thich Nhat Hanh's books, which I think is a very profound title, is For a Future to be Possible. For a future to be possible. So how do we live today that makes a future possible? Since we're so completely intertwined with each other. So, thank you, and thank you for my son for pointing all this out.